Hi, everyone. I want to start by saying thank you for joining me today on the webinar. I would say it's nice to see you, but I can only see your names on the screen. It's a very interesting way to share. But I look forward to showing you a lot of artwork today. And and by the way, I'll introduce myself. My name's Lynn Shermer. I am a fine artist. I work in basically all media, pretty much. I do sculpture, painting, and drawing. But that activity does not support me, like most artists. I can't make a living at it. So I'm a web designer by day. I run my own web design business. And I am also a survivor of extreme abuse. I survived private torture in ritual settings and government mind control operations. And I'm still in recovery. I've been in recovery a long time, most of my adult life, going through various stages. And still working on it, but doing pretty well. And being active as an artist helps me a great deal with that. So I also want to put out some warnings. A lot of the visuals that I have can be triggering in a number of ways. Most of my artwork is figurative, which means I use the body to express myself. So there's nudity. A lot of the content is about abuse, memories of abuse. I'll be showing at least one drawing that I didn't do, that a partner of mine did, that has fully rendered faces of known perpetrators in it. And I'll warn you before I put that one up on the screen. I'll warn you. And also, I have some pictures that have devices, various torture devices depicted in them. And I've made some notes here for myself so that I can shout out a trigger warning when I get close to one of those. But the general public doesn't, you know, no one has experience of these things. It tends to go over their head a little bit, except for the emotional component. But I've been told for survivors, it's both validating and very difficult to look at my work. So just be prepared, and I'm not going to be offended in any way if you can't look at something, and I'm sorry in advance if it does upset you. But my work is all about telling. It's all about telling my story, so that's why that content is in it. So I have five sections to my presentation, and I think after each section, then I'll open it up for 5 minutes of question and answer. And I think Jeannie went over the rules for that just moments ago.
I went over them moments ago, and I also put them on the chat so you can refer back to them.
Yes. Okay. So I'll go ahead and start. I think that covers my intro. Like I said, I'm an artist, and I'm very, very fortunate that I, 6 years ago now, got involved with the major Center for Visual Art in Seattle. I live in Seattle, Washington, by the way. and just a huge, I don't know whether it was intuition on my part or what, I was out looking for new studio space. I'd been working out of my home for like 10 years, and also because I was working out of my home because I wasn't doing very well in my recovery, and I couldn't sustain a studio or produce a lot of work. But there came a point where I was ready to expand, and I knew that I wanted a studio down in the Pioneer Square region of Seattle, because that is where most of the galleries and artist studios are. And I'm going to go ahead and go to slide number 2. So this building here, this is called the Toshiro Kaplan Building. And these bottom two floors are 100 years old. And there used to be a farmer's market below here. And we still have some of the old signage, you know, with the hand and the finger pointing down the ramp to the farmer's market. So this is an historic building in Pioneer Square, like I said, in the historic district of Seattle. And in 2004, this building reopened. A national nonprofit named Art Space Projects, headquartered in Minneapolis, came to Pioneer Square because the neighborhood was being gentrified. You know, it's such a common process. Artists move into a neighborhood, they fix it up, they get people coming in, they get businesses coming in, and then the rents start to go up, and then the artists can't afford it anymore. So this goes on in cycles all, you know, in every city. And a bunch of people in the community didn't want Pioneer Square to lose its artists and its artist spaces. So they got very active, got the city and state and eventually the federal government involved, and got this national nonprofit to come in and develop this building. So all these floors up here, this is all new construction, and it's all residential up there. And the building takes up an entire city block. We have 50 units of residential, and they're large units. They're at minimum 800 square feet. And they're designed to be live, work, housing for artists. And it's low-income housing. It's tax credit housing. So it's just an awesome project. And ArtSpace builds these. They have over 20 projects now across the country. So if you live in a city with an ArtSpace project, then you might be familiar with what they do. But when after this building was established in the neighborhood where most of the galleries still are in Seattle, it became the sort of nexus for visual art activity. On the first, second, and here on the back of the building, we have three floors of commercial space. We have a dozen work-only studios and about a dozen commercial storefronts, and they all have to be arts-related businesses. That's the mandate of the building. So basically all of these spaces that you see here, except for the coffee shop, which also shows artwork, are galleries and artist studios. And the other great thing about the neighborhood is that now for 30 years, the Gallery Association has an event that everyone just calls First Thursday. So the first Thursday of every month, the galleries are open late between 5 and 9 p.m. And they serve wine and they have their big opening reception for their artists. And the public comes out to see all the new shows. And it's a very old tradition, and many activities happen outside in the street. There's another area a few blocks from this building where a lot of artists set up in a park. And so it's just a huge amount of activity, and there are literally thousands of people who come out for First Thursday every month. So when I was looking for a studio back in 2004, I knew I wanted to be on the Art Walk because it's this huge bonus. I mean, usually when you're working in a studio, you're isolated, you work by yourself, and then you go and you have a show in a venue maybe once a year, maybe twice a year. But if you're on the Art Walk, you have an immediate audience. You have hundreds of people coming through your studio. You can sell work, or you can do what I do. You can. That's where you put out your soapbox. So that's what I did, and I was one of the very first ones to get one of these work-only studios in the TK building, and this is my entrance right here, 306, and there's a little hallway gallery that I used to curate. It's called Corridor Gallery, and if you walk up these stairs, the door right to the right is my studio, and I'll show you that. So this is my studio. And here it is, it's all cleaned up for First Thursday. So once a month I go through this craziness of a few days of, you know, cleaning up all my art materials and shoving everything away in a corner, all my tools and my paints and everything, and sweeping it and hanging my work. And it's a nice little practice to go through every month. Well, most months. I'm not open every month, but most months I'm open. So this is the door to come in, and it's, you know, it's a basic square room. I don't have any windows. I couldn't afford the windows. They're too expensive, the ones with the windows, which was kind of sad because I like to work in color, and you need natural light to work in color. So a lot of my work the past 5 or 6 years is monotone, but that's okay. It works, and I can produce the monotone work very quickly, which is important if you're going to be open for First Thursday. But here it is, and I have a desk here, and hundreds of people come through. They pass by my door. They come in. I greet them. I have my biography, my resume, my artist statement, and cards, and a guest book on this table. And if they want to know more about me, then they'll pick up my material, they'll sign my guest book, and after they look at the work. So these were taken, I think, this past summer. This is some of my new work. I'll get into it later. But so this is how I access the public, and it's, like I said, it's fairly regular, and it's just for someone who desperately wants to get the story out about real child abuse and mind control programs, it's a great opportunity. So the next slide. This is a bit of my artist statement, and don't feel obligated to read it. I just put it up there to give an example of what the audience sees when they decide to, read a little bit more about me when they're intrigued with the work. But the biggest point that I wanted to make with putting this artist statement here is always at the end I put this, if you would like to know more, please ask, or please feel free to ask. So what happens is that I get people coming in. I get a lot of people also who walk by the door and they look in and they see the nudity, or they see the emotional heaviness of the work, and they just keep going. They don't, they're sort of timid and they don't want to go in. So I get that. And when I first started doing the open studios, that was really hard to take. It was very difficult to have people, just glance in and sort of shrug off the work, because, I look at it and I'm thinking about all of the risk that I've taken in producing and showing the work, and I'm thinking, don't you see that? Well, no, they don't. And that's sort of what my presentation is about today. What the public sees is totally different than what you think, or, maybe what you want them to see. So, and that's what I've learned over the last 5 years. And I'm going to be asking you guys to help me sort of hone my methods here a little bit so that I can get better at telling the story. But so I have this statement out, and if they come in and they see my artwork and they're intrigued or they're moved, and then they read my statement, it says, please feel free to ask. And I mean, this is a pretty heavy statement. I talk about being a survivor of torture and medical experimentation, and that can be, just reading that is a shock for a lot of people. They don't know what's going on. So those brave souls that come over to me with this, their face is kind of in shock, and they come over and they say, okay, I'd like to know more. And then that's when I talk to them. And usually I ask them a couple of questions first. I ask them, if they've ever heard of anything like that before, or what they saw in the artwork. And then I sort of, I gauge where they are with their knowledge level and their comfort level, and then I give them an explanation. And again, it took me a good year and a half to get good at that. I wasn't so good at it at first, and I think the next slide is a bit on that. But so I've had at least one reaction that terrifies me to get. It's that reaction where I'm looking in their face, and they just have this, they're looking at me like I'm nuts, right? They look at me like I'm absolutely crazy. Like, none of this can be real. But really, that's only happened in a big, embarrassing way once. So I think that's pretty good for 5 years. That's pretty good. So here are some of the other materials I keep out on my table. I have these folders with printouts of some of the stuff, and then some are books. Like, I have Valerie Wolf and Chris DiNicola and other survivors' testimony at the radiation hearings in 1995. I have Wanda Carriker's media packet. I have Carol Rutz's Indiana University lecture. And I'll trade these out. And you can see the whole list here of various things. And then, of course, Kathleen Sullivan's book, Carol Rutz's book, And recently there have been a few new books out, a new book by Nick Bryant on the Franklin scandal, so I have that out, and I'm a huge fan of his. I am such a fan of his. So I talk about his book all the time. And so that's what I put out for people, and they sort of, you know, busily browse through that and nervously glance at me, and sometimes they ask questions, or sometimes they'll just write a nice note in my guest book and leave. But it has an effect. It's had a cumulative effect over the years. So I'll go to the next one. And maybe I should warn you about this one. This piece is it's a little difficult. I think now I'll review some studio shows that I've had. And I already talked about the worst reaction. I already told you about that. This is an example of a piece that I did, and I could only do it because I have the open studios and the first Thursday. This is actually real meat. It's a piece of pork butt. But I did this... studio installation in the months following a show that I did in 2007, and I'm going to review that show next and show you the artwork from that. And I was so disheartened because I did this humongous show, and it was so important, and the work was so strong, and there was a press blackout on it. I couldn't get anyone to come. I was going to show the movie Conspiracy of Silence, and I couldn't, literally one other person came, so we didn't even show the movie. It was so disappointing, and because I was naive, I had these naive hopes that, you know, if I just tell people these bad things are going on, they're going to want to know. I still had a bit of that belief going on. I don't have that belief anymore. It took me a while to get that. But I was just devastated, and so I was this is my little studio temper tantrum. So I've been making these sculptures. Let's see, I'm trying to get the ball in this. There we go. I've been making these little finger toe sculptures. So I had those floating around, and I had a phrase in my head that was from one of my perpetrators. So I wanted to express that and sort of process that out of my body, and that's where the meat comes from. And I'd like to tell you the phrase that I don't think it's a commonly used one. Well, I don't need to tell you the phrase, but he's basically comparing me to meat. So that's where the meat comes from. And that's what these scraps of paper here, that's what it says the phrase over and over again, and sort of winds its way through the meat. But that's what the sculpture is about. So it felt really good to make it, and then when people saw it, you know, audiences are a lot about spectacle. If you have some element of spectacle in your work, you're going to get their attention. So, you know, most people came in and they said, oh, there's meat hanging. And they were so intrigued with that, it drew them into the work. So that was really good. And then the other thing was, this is my temper tantrum now with audiences and the art community. It's kind of naughty. So I put these posters up around the sculpture, and it says, good Germans. And I imagine that most of you understand what that phrase refers to. It refers to the general populace in Germany who were good people, but they were in denial about what was going on with the Nazis, and that's one of the things that allowed a lot of the atrocities to happen. So that's what that's about. But what stunned me was how many young people who came through asked me what that meant, because they didn't know it from history. They didn't have that knowledge. So that was a little stunning to me. It made me feel old, too. But anyway, so I had my little temper tantrum, and everyone loved it. That was the irony. People still talk about the sculpture and want me to, you know, recreate it in various venues, and I'm just stunned. But that's the way it is. You know, like I said, you never know what the audience how they're going to respond, or you know what they're going to take. So I think we're at the end of the first section here. I think this is all about my studio shows and open studios. And next, I'm going to go into a show that I had in a gallery. So if there are any questions, I see the chat's been moving. Do you want to open it up for questions, Jeannie?
Yes, I see a question here from Beginning to Hope. What if a perp comes in and sees that paper and notes? Is there any security there? What about when she leaves the studio? What if they're sly and wait until a different day? This sounds like quite the out of there and risky thing to do.
Yes, it is risky. And I've had some scary people visit me in my studio. But I don't have to go outside to go home. I live upstairs in the residential part. And everyone here, you know, they believe me to varying degrees, much more than they used to when I first started. But they know about me, and they know what I'm doing. My neighbors know. My neighbors upstairs, my neighbors downstairs, they look out for me. No one could do anything here to me except trigger me or sort of intimidate me, because people know. All I have to do is raise my voice, and there'll be half a dozen people running, and no, you're not going to screw with Lynn. So I'm really fortunate that way. I love my community here, and yeah, they protect me. So it is, and it is risky. But to me, it's worth it. It's totally worth it.
Have you ever had any kind of retaliation from perps?
Only in the form of, oh, we're gonna try and screw with your head. We're gonna call you and try to trigger you. I did, when I first had my studio, I had a good 6 months of sort of insecure residential. I'll put it that way. I was couch surfing. And occasionally I would sleep in my studio. So there was one time when they got in, to the studio. And that was pretty extreme. But I'm sure a lot of you guys know that that's part of the deal of being a survivor. I mean, we have no safe houses yet. And we do the best that we can. And but I was the most vulnerable then, and that time has passed now. So, and I recovered from that. So it's so important to me to try to tell my story to the public that I take the risk. And occasionally I get to complain about the risk too, and people listen to me, so yeah.
You have a right to complain. do you have an overall label or name for your studio or show? Does it hint at what the public will be seeing, what it's about?
Yes, it's called Shermer Studio, and there's a website called First Thursday Seattle, and I think it's .org, and I advertise my upcoming shows on that website when I can, when I remember to do it. But it's listed on that website and on my LynnShermer.com website too. I have a slide at the end with a couple of my websites on it. So. Oh, thank you, Mary. That's nice. I just caught that.
Yeah. You know,
are there any more questions?
A lot of people would not dare to do this.
I'm sorry, what?
A lot of people would not dare to be out there like you are.
I know.
It really is inspiring.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Okay, one more question. Phoenix. Oh, Phoenix would like to know the phrases that are written on the paper pieces that were put within them throughout the art show.
Oh, the phrase on the sculpture, and those of you who are easily triggered, you might want to tune out. It's not a proper trigger phrase, but it's just a demeaning thing to say to someone. It just says, "You are meat," and that's what it says over and over again. So I don't know. I might be the only one that heard that in the labs, but I had one of the guys like to throw that at me now and then when he wanted to demoralize me even more. So
okay,
I have
one
exorcised
more question,
it.
And then we'll stop.
Sculpture.
Does your art pay the rent mortgage? Do you get SSI? Do you have a side job? You just said you did web design. Does that support what you do?
It does. I run my own web design business, and that pays my bills and buys my groceries. Not always to the level that I want, but it's working so far. So.
Okay. All right. So should we go on to the next section?
Sure. So now I'm going to talk about, and a bit of this next slide might be triggering. It has some perp faces on it. It's a part of that drawing that I talked about when I first started by my partner in the show. But in 2007, so I'm going to put the slide up now. So in 2007, I did this show called Franklin and Madeline. And Franklin refers to the Franklin case, which is a case in the late 1980s that started out in Nebraska, in Omaha, Nebraska, with the investigation of a savings and loan there, because we had that huge savings and loan scandal in the 80s. And the Nebraska State Senate it started investigating why the savings and loan failed and ended up discovering a child trafficking network that served people in the first Bush White House, which is, you know, pretty extraordinary. And if you're familiar with the case, you'll know that there were deaths associated with it, and intimidation and manipulation of the media, cover up by the FBI, the CIA. It's a huge case. And it's a really important case to present to the public if you want them, you know, for me, if I want them to get my history, and because, you know, it's the same sort of activities. So, and the great thing about Franklin is it's been proven by Nick Bryant in his recent book that was published called The Franklin Scandal. It was published in May, and if you haven't, in May of 2009, if you haven't gotten the book yet, I encourage you to do so. Just reading the first chapter is incredibly validating if you're a survivor, so do get that book. And also, he's making a documentary, so keep your eyes out for that. So I met this artist, another figurative artist in Seattle named James Sikotko. And I met him while I was curating the little hallway gallery outside of my studio door there. And I had him show his work in 2006. And we got along really well. His work is very similar to mine in a lot of ways. In some ways, much more intellectual. He's a really smart cookie and very clever with what he does with his artwork and text. And he read about the Franklin scandal, and then he started studying all these incidences of the abuse of power, extreme abuses of power, by people who run our society. So he was fascinated with Franklin, and he felt compelled to make visual art about it. So these images here are, was a postcard for the show. The one on the right is, that's me, Madeline. So he's Franklin. He's presenting, in the show, he's presenting artwork that is narrative and sort of documents the case and related cases. And then I'm doing personal experience. I'm saying that here's my artwork by someone showing you what it's like to maybe have been one of these kids. So that's where we get Franklin and Madeline. And Madeline's one of my alter names assigned when I was a kid. So that's Franklin and Madeline. And this is a statement that he came up with for our PR. And I thought it was great, so I put it on the slide here. I'm gonna go to the next slide now, which is the opening. Here's the opening. And we put the show on at a gallery a few blocks from where I am right now, a little bit out of the gallery district. And it's run by these three guys. And they're so cool. They were totally supportive. And I'm telling you, nobody else in town would have touched this thing because of the content. It's too explosive. You know, you're not going to get any sales out of it. And as James and I discovered, you're not going to get a lot of people coming to your opening. Especially if you make the mistake like I did and put in the PR, come see artwork about child trafficking. Yay! You know, and yeah, I learned that was my huge lesson with the show is don't, if you're doing a show about child trafficking, or Franklin, don't mention it. You just say, oh, big, giant, new figurative paintings, and then you get people to come. But if you tell them what it's going to be, they won't come, because they, you know, when they go to an art opening, I guess it's like a movie or going to a music show, they want to be entertained. They don't want to know. So, duh, Lynn learns another lesson. So here's our opening, and these people are all my dear friends. there are no strangers there. Well, there were a couple of survivors came, and that was great. It was great to meet them. They heard through the grapevine about it, and that was wonderful. But everybody else there was like a close friend. And bless them for coming. Good on them for coming, and they were highly disturbed, and a couple of them got mad at me because they were so upset by the work, which is not fair, but hey, you know, human beings, so. But this piece back here, this is one of my absurdly large pieces that I've done since I've had my studio. I love working large. I love moving my whole arm, getting my whole body into the action of pouring this emotion out onto the media. And this piece is actually 24 feet long and 9 feet tall. So it is now rolled up in a tube. I don't know if it's ever going to see the light of day again because it's so huge. But it's called Burden, Amputation, I Deliver My Head. So you can probably get what those things reference. Here I am as an adult carrying a bunch of kid parts. And then this one is about a memory. And a bit of Madeline here. I drew Madeline. And some other parts being complicit and giving the head away. So that's what that piece is all about. But so the next one, I'm actually gonna show a full slide of that one that I said had pictures of perps in it. So prepare yourself. James did render their faces quite well. And actually, I don't recognize a few of them. Maybe you guys will. I don't know. I hope not. God, I hope not. But I'm about to put that up. There's also there's a picture of a little girl that's quite disturbing. So if you want to look away, I mean, the next one, it's not as symbolic as mine. Mine's more, you know, it's emotional, it's body, but it's more, you know, symbolism. And his is just straight out narrative. So. Big warning, big trigger warning. So I'm going to put that one up next. So this is called Party, and when I first saw it, I was triggered out of my brain. I couldn't look at it for a while, though I admired the heck out of it. This thing is 10 foot long, and it's all done with pencil. It's all done in graphite. It took him months to complete the work, and it's just, to me, it's a masterpiece. And you know, I wish we could have traveled the show. That was our plan. Our plan was to take Franklin and Madeline across the country and you know, educate the public about the Franklin case and child trafficking and these horrible parties and everything. But presenting this material was so stressful for James, unfortunately, that he did not want to go forward. In fact, he had the impulse to leave the opening. And so, but he was very brave to do the work and to put it out there in that show. And he still has the work, and maybe in a few years we might be able to do the same thing. But he got all these, all the kids' faces come from milk cartons and missing kid photos. And I get that the central figure is really disturbing. Really difficult, but if you look at all these characters, I'm sure you can recognize a few of them. I know these guys and this one, and he's obvious, and this is Larry King, of course, from the Franklin scandal, and it's also a tradition for artists when they do portraits of the ruling classes throughout history, of monarchs or like the royal family, to place themselves in the audience. So the artist actually drew himself here in the piece. And then he included some figures from history who are known to be, you know, horrible abusers. And this is one of them, I think, from the 16th century. There was a nobleman who pretty much decimated the population on his land or the land surrounding by these horrible activities. So it's an amazing piece, and it really hit the audience hard and made the show difficult for them. But it was important to show it. So I'm going to go on to the next one. The imagery won't be anywhere near as hard, I don't think, but it does have a few little more naive drawings in it of lab sessions, but they're very faint, so I want to give you that warning. So this is my other piece that I had. So I had that huge drawing that was just like fine art stuff, and then this is more of a conceptual piece. Well, it has a concept in it, but this is my important piece that I had in the show. It's called Bio, and it's actually, this is another long one. It's 17 feet long. I stretched it between two columns. But all these drawings here, these are all copies from my journals, and I've got like 20 years of journals, and very quickly done. And actually, it's a different alter that draws in my journals than does the fine artwork. It's a totally different part of me. So these aren't very sophisticated, but they're okay. I mean, I'm not putting them down. They're just different than my usual way of making art. But these are all journal drawings, and what I did is I sandwiched them between two layers of semi-translucent drafting film. That means you can kind of see through it. And then I tacked the layers down just in various spots along the piece. So only where I tacked the layers together can you see very clearly these journal drawings. And in all the other places, you can't see them unless you go up to the piece and press your hand against the paper. So what I'm doing here is I'm actually forcing people to, they have to make the choice to look at the drawings. They can't just passively glance. They have to work at looking at these drawings of absolute horrible lab sessions. So to me, that was, it was amazing to see people do that. It was an amazing experience. And I actually hope to hang this piece again in some other venue. It was just so gratifying because they did. They went and they pressed down on the paper and they would look at each little vignette and they would read what the notes were, and it was wonderful. But I started here at the left with my birth, and I did some little drawings on the outside too and made little notes. And then from earliest, you know, journal drawings and notes from my earliest memory, and then going all the way up until I'm almost my age now. But I have pictures, drawings of my memories of what my perpetrators look like, the facilities, the rooms, the devices, various sessions here. So, and they did. And actually, the guy who runs the gallery, Ouch My Eye, it's a great name for a gallery, Ouch My Eye, he said he took, this was up for a month in his space, and he said it took him the entire month, but he read every note, he looked at every drawing, and he just recently told me that. I didn't know that. I saw him just a few weeks ago, and he told me that, and I almost cried. I said, my God, you're brave. And but there are people out there like that. They exist. So it's really helpful to know that. I think, let me see what my next one is. That might be the end of Franklin. Yes, that's the end of Franklin. So if you guys have any questions about Franklin, then we can do the question and answer thing. Yes.
Phoenix wanted to know who the guy with the glasses and gray hair is in that painting.
Oh, and the one...
Yeah, and I wonder if you could name some of the other people, too.
Oh, this guy? So this is Gottlieb, Sidney Gottlieb back here.
Right, okay.
And I think this is Alan Dulles, although his hair looks a little dark. This is Ewan Cameron.
Oh, my God.
And this is Larry King again. This is Jeb Bush behind the girl. And, you know, I can't remember who said it. I was looking at that this morning going, I knew who that was. And I don't know, maybe I have a block. These two guys are really bothering me because I don't know who they are. So if anyone knows who they are, go ahead and chat it, chat the name up there, because I'd like to know. So I'll get that off the screen. How about that? Any more questions?
Since they're actual, let me stay with that. Since they're actual faces, did you get any threats or pressure not to show them? I mean, I know some of these people are dead. Gottlieb and Cameron are dead, but Larry King's not.
You know, there's nothing provable. I know James was extraordinarily nervous, but I don't think he got any phone calls that I know of. I think once the work was up and he saw what he was really doing, it just hit him and he freaked out.
Uh-huh.
And, nothing. I, as a survivor, I get general threats all the time. I get threats not to draw, you know, to stop painting. I get them messing with my system, trying to get me to stop making artwork. But obviously none of that has worked. So, not yet.
And you can blow it, you just blow it off and keep on doing it.
I just keep doing it, and some of my helpers tell me it keeps me a little bit safe, because if I've established this reputation in Seattle and I'm putting this work out all the time, then if something does happen to me, then it's immediately suspect, you know? So, I don't know.
Oh, there's so many.
Is there another question?
Yeah, there's so many questions coming up. Mary's asking, she's an artist. She sort of has an artist block at this point. She can't do it. She doesn't feel trained. She feels sort of less than. You know, what? Do you have any advice for her?
I just saw a dear friend of mine that I've known for 15 years, but I never met in person. I finally met her in person last week, and she is what's called an outsider artist. And outsider art's a really big deal right now. And this woman has an amazing career. She's done far better than I have. She has gallery representation in the Netherlands and is about to go to Japan, and she shows in Manhattan every year. I mean, she has a real career. And she's quite well known. So don't worry about being trained. And if you can find any internal blocks against being creative or telling, if you process those and work on that, then creating is going to be a lot easier. Try not to be critical. And, you know, do it for you. You don't have to do it for an audience. Just getting the material out in another form other than speaking can be a marvelous process in and of itself. You don't even have to show it anywhere. So don't be critical. Let yourself go and just do it. Just do it.
Mary, if you need to take a break and go eat, do it. Take care of yourself, you know. You can always come back and listen to the recording on the website. One more question about the party. Why does Jeb Bush have deformed feet?
Well, I think the artist let his ire get to him there. So he, those are supposed to be satyr type feet.
Cloven hooves.
Yeah. You're saying the guy's evil.
I'm not sure which person she's referring to, but Ed says that one of them looks like a German doctor from the camps, maybe Mengele. When he was younger.
Yeah. I don't know if I see Mengele in there, or if I do, it's a really old picture of him.
Okay.
Or, I mean, a really late picture of him, rather.
All right. One more question, and then we're going to close down the questions and start all over again.
Okay.
How do you figure out how to get funded for art materials, or get any, you know, get art materials when you're dead poor?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
When you're living on, like, below the poverty line, how do you find money for your art materials? Or do you get, are there places that will help you with getting art supplies?
No, I have to buy them. But I, you know, since I'm self-employed, everything that I can take off my taxes helps me. So when I have a big show, like I just did, I did a huge sculpture show, and I had spent a bit of money. I probably spent $400-something on materials. I'll just write it off my taxes.
Okay. So you don't know of any funding sources that would help out?
You know, there are tons of grants for artists. Mm-hmm. In fact, I administer a grant, a new one that just started a couple years ago. I might get into that story later as sort of a antidote, an uplifting thing, but... I apply for grants all the time. I don't have good luck at getting them because of my content, you know.
Uh-huh. If you
the people
have any
who decide who gets a grant are the same people who decide who gets a show, and I don't do well in this small community with those folks all the time. They're timid, you know. They don't want to ruffle any feathers. So,
if you have any information about grants, maybe you can write it to me in an email, and I'll post it to people.
Oh, sure. You know, most grants for artists are local. So the grants that I know about here aren't going to help someone across the country, mm-hmm. but you can always contact your mayor's office. Your county will probably have an art program. There are various nonprofit organizations who probably run grant programs for artists. But just Google search probably help you a lot more than I could.
Okay.
Although a couple of listing services that I can forward those addresses.
Okay. Should we go on to the next part?
Okay. Let's see. So, this next show is called Harlow Monkey. And this show took place in a gallery on the north side of town. It's called Form Space Atelier. And it's a little independent, again, this is pretty much, these are the only venues that I show in when I'm not showing in my studio, are these non-commercial, independent, little spaces that don't have a regular group of artists who show. And that's because independent people run them, so they're not taking monetary risks when they show my work or the risk of offending, you know, some higher-ups around Seattle that don't necessarily want me to be talking about this. So here I am at Form Space Atelier in 2008, and this is the first time that I did major sculpture work. I actually, literally, these are my first sculptures since I was a kid and played around with clay and made ashtrays and that kind of thing. And I was quite pleased. Oh, actually, I have to take that back. When I was in college, I majored in industrial design, and we had to make models. So I did, in a sense, make sculptures in college. But yeah, I was very glad. And then this gallery space is a big entryway to an old theater. And outside these windows, there's the sidewalk, of course. But then you see how we're looking up here, and there's this handrail. There's this huge stair that goes down to an old theater and a nightclub. And so in conjunction with these art openings, the director has panels, and we decided to invite a half a dozen independent art critics to have a discussion in conjunction with my show, which was a really stupid thing to do. Because I'm sure you get it immediately. It's like, oh, I'm going to invite all the critics to my show. Hopefully one of them will write about it, right? Well, you just don't do that. It was a dumb idea. But they all were, and they had their discussion, and no one said a word about my work. You know, I tried to get them to talk about social issues and politics in contemporary art, and they did talk about those issues a bit, but no one ever mentioned my work. And then as they were leaving, they gave me a perfunctory, oh, good job, Lynn, but they never really looked at it, and then one of them was really critical and said, you know, you need to study other artists and how they relate to the audience, and because you're really, you know, you're not getting it. And I'm like, oh, God. So it was just this nightmare. But I did talk to a couple of them when I was outside, and I got into my history a little bit because I wanted to know, do they believe me? You know, what do they really think? Because they're not talking to me about the issues. So eventually one of them just turned around and says, yes, we believe you. And, but they didn't want to talk about it, so then they left. But at least I got that out of them. But anyway, this Harlow Monkey, the name of the show, refers to Harlow, who did the studies of attachment with, I think they were rhesus monkeys, and it was back in the 50s. And he would isolate baby monkeys from their mothers, take them away, make them orphans, and then he would give them the choice between a fake mother that was made out of wire and produced milk, or a fake mother that was made out of sort of stuffed animal material. And he would give them that choice, and they would spend most of their time with the stuffed animal one. So he established that physical nurturing and attachment is integral to the health, the development of social animals, primates, humans, us. So these sculptures are about my feeling of what my beginning attachments were and how unhealthy they were and how lacking they were. And I'm looking back at my sculpture now and thinking, maybe the critic was kind of right. Not too successful there, but I still like how original they are. So anyway, I'll go to the next one. Oh, I should have warned you. I'm sorry. I should have warned you. These are tough images. I'm totally sorry about that. These are full-color paintings that I had hanging around in my studio that I had started years earlier, and then I finished, and it's pretty much the only full-color work that I've done recently. But these are autobiographical, and I had these hanging with the sculpture because these, to me, were related to that theme as well. But I'm sorry about the triggering nature. There's obviously several levels here. But again, nobody really reacted to this work. The only reaction that I got when someone wrote about it, and it wasn't even a critic, it was just some guy on a blog writing in the comments section. He was very complimentary of my work in general, but he said, Lynn speaks honestly about what it's like to be a woman and to feel distortions in your body, your body image, your internal body image. So I was like, well, that's not quite what it's about, but thanks for the compliment. But so they just, you know, people write their own experience on the work. They're not going to get the various references and the content unless you tell them again. So, but I'm sure a lot of you guys recognize it, you know, what this symbolizes. I'm taking the iconic image of the Madonna and Child, and I'm turning it. I'm using it to show my adult self caring for an altar child, and what's happening to the altar child, and yeah, so that's what that one's about. And then this one, it has a lot of elements in it, but again, it's all related to a programming mechanism, the black hole. Okay, well, I'll go to the next one. And I think the next one is, I don't think there's anything triggering about it. It does have some nudity, but emotional content is quite different. And, oh, here, I'm at the end of Harlow Monkey. So if anyone has any questions about Harlow Monkey, let's do the question.
Said that she was told by her professor that if she ever mentioned cult, she would never be able to have a career in art. Wrong, I guess, right? Who is the man?
I think things are changing with that.
Yeah. Who are the faces in the second, in the black hole one? The face
in
profile and the one that looks like somebody from the Old Testament?
That's a combination face of my father and a young programmer that I met when I was a really young kid.
And the guy in profile?
This guy here in the, oh wait, I can't get this thing to move. There it goes. This guy right here?
No, to the right. That's left.
Oh, this one.
Who's that one?
Oh, this is one of my alters.
Oh, okay. Now go all the way to the other side of the painting. That one.
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a little kid altar.
Oh, okay.
Sort of a ghosty figure there.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Are you in touch with your family? Are your parents still alive? Did your father recognize, if he is, did he recognize himself in that painting? Does he ever look at the paintings?
I'm sure my parents have seen the work. I note when they visit my website.
Mm-hmm.
I know where they live. Yes, they're both still alive. And no, I cut off contact with my parents in my late 20s. And I've only had contact with them when it was absolutely unavoidable since. So I did that quite young. And even when I had no idea what all my memories were, I just had a feeling that they just weren't safe to be around, and they're not. And the last time I saw my mother, she appeared with no warning and no notice on my front doorstep, and that was back in 2001 or 2002, sometime way back then.
So you know that they're seeing what you're doing, but you have no idea what their reaction is.
Well, you know, they're both multiples, and they've always had extreme, like a range of responses to me as a being,
mm-hmm.
and from all the way from one extreme to the other. So there's a part of my mother that's actually proud that I'm speaking out and doing this, because she's told me, so... But there are other parts of her that I'm sure, I know, you know, try to hinder me and try to harm me. So.
Yeah. That was in your late 20s that you cut off contact. Do you mind telling us how old you are now, how long you've been out of contact?
Oh, I'm 47.
47. Thank you. Okay, let's go on to the next part.
Okay. So this next one, and it's quite a jump in time, because... What happened in the interim is I had a dear friend. She was like the matriarch of this building, this artist community that I'm in. She lived in the neighborhood for 20 years. She's an art history professor at various local colleges, an artist herself. She ran her own silk clothing business. And she was my dear friend. And in the fall of 08, she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And so I literally did not get into my studio for 9 months. I took care of her, and then I was the executor of her estate, and so that was my life for the last half of 08 and the first half of 09 was that, and that was pretty incredible to be trusted like that after so many horrible relationships my whole life, and then to have this beautiful, strong woman look at me and go, I trust you, I'm putting my life in your hands, and I'm putting my estate in your hands, and then that was just an amazing, amazing thing, and I miss her terribly. I miss her to this day. And anyway, I won't get off into that, but it's part of where this drawing comes from. She knew that my dissolving her estate and setting up the grant and all of that was going to be ongoing work for, you know, it's going to be a ton of work right away and then ongoing for years. So she left me a good chunk of money and ordered me to go on vacation after she passed and after, you know, I got some things settled. So I did. Last March I went to Paris. And that was something we discussed because she had always wanted to go to Paris and she had never gone. And so I took some of her ashes with me and I went to Paris and I went to her other favorite town where she had been, Florence, Italy. But I went and saw all the, in her name, I went and saw all the great works of Western art at the Louvre and the Uffizi in Florence and various other museums. And just had the time of my life. And you can see that in this drawing. It's a little embarrassing, but you can see the good and the bad here. You can see that I had a good time and connected with a French guy. Sorry, people. But, the, you know, it's always a mixed, it's always a mixed experience for me anyway. You know, I'm not fully healed yet, so even when I have a good time, there's other stuff going on there and weird things get triggered. But that's what this piece is about. But I love it, and audiences just love it. And so that was part of my show last fall called Program. So I'll go on to the next. And this is a major piece in that show. It's very, very tall. It's like 6 foot tall. But to me, this piece is about interactions between alters and some that are clinging to their attachment to perpetrators and other ones trying to get them out. But The Four Corners is the name of a program that was... that I was conditioned with when I was a really young child, and it refers to the initial splitting of the system, the altar system, and how it's organized. So these four different spots symbolize that and how it's degraded and what's happened to it over time. And I think the only people who would really get a lot of what's going on here are, you know, people who've worked intensely with survivors of my age group. So it was over the head of most of the audience, but I gave them a drawing. So there's that. And here's the next one. So this is, most of the work in the show is just straight autobiographical, you know, and the piece is talking about different experiences and, you know, a lot of altar portraits. These are all portraits of altars and how we relate to each other and, you know, around certain memories or certain experiences or inside the system. So this one's called Headless. The main figure here has no head, but there are other heads around, and they're all kind of blending and substituting for each other. So that's really all that piece is about. And then this one's called Tween, and that was, you know, you might be able to tell what that's about from this part of this figure here, but it's pretty straightforward. It's how my altar system actually appears to me inside and how it feels to me, the altar system that handled that experience of when I was a very young teen and was pregnant. So that's what that piece is about. And I'm gonna go, let me see if I can, I'm gonna go all the way back to the first one, because the biggest piece in Program was revolved around this jar. This is a jar of letters between me and childhood friends. Really old, well, envelopes, actually. I didn't keep the letters in there. But I moved around a lot when I was a kid, and so I'd make these little girlfriends, and then I'd move, and then we'd write to each other because, you know, this is long before the internet and couldn't use long distance. Mom and Dad aren't going to let you do that. So I had pen pals everywhere. And so I have these boxes of old letters. And a lot of these people, I've come to figure out, I've reconnected with them, and I believe that a lot of them were trafficked too, and that's why we had a sort of connection, and we still have that same sort of connection. So, but anyway, so I put this bowl out at my opening of the Program show, and I had written on the back of select envelopes trigger phases. And I invited the audience to come and pick an envelope and bring it to me and read the trigger phrase to me. And then I would act out whatever behavior or conditioning that was supposed to elicit. So for me, I went through a bunch of programs that I had already dismantled in my system and recovered from. And that's, you know, that's material that I used. I didn't use anything that would actually work. But I did, and I, you know, a couple people, they pulled the envelope and they came over and stood right in front of me and they read the trigger phrase, and I did whatever. I did whatever I was supposed to do. Sometimes I would just, you know, say a phrase right back to them, or I would I would move my face, you know, I would change my facial expression or my body movement. But the exercise is supposed to give them the idea of, you know, a very general idea about how programming works. And if it didn't, then it probably made them think about childhood memory and you know, what are called mnemonics, you know, objects or ideas that remind you of other things. So it had many levels of meaning for people. So, but that was a really good exercise for me. And people, I told people I was going to do that, and they're like, "You're crazy! Why are you?" Well, it was a really good exercise for me, and I felt like I was conquering it. You know, like I was in control of it. So that was a really good thing to do. Now I have to work my way back to where I was. Or actually, okay, I think we are at another question and answer. I think that's the end of program, and then I only have one more section left after that, so. Or are there questions about program?
I have a comment, and that is that Australian Aboriginal paintings, they have whole stories of relationships between people or groups of people or people in the land that are told in just visual form, just lots of dots and patterns of dots. And
uh-huh.
That's sort of like what the Four Corners reminded me of, that it's a story of the relationship between your altars and the program that they put in, and also changing over time, that the corners, as you work on it, they change.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not as rigid.
Yeah, I really like that analogy. I'm gonna have to read about Aboriginal art now. I really like that.
It was incredible to me because I just thought it was an abstract design, and then I realized that they were talking about meeting with the government to work on water, you know, water supplies, stuff like this.
Uh huh.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Are there any other? I see comments. Are there any other questions?
No. Did you have spin programming?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And actually, there's an account of it. I wrote... I have an alter who's a really good writer. I wish you were around more. She's really good. And I had a memory back in 2005. I actually was triggered into a memory of a spin session. And I have conscious front section memory of the phone call where my perp handler, triggered me into that memory. And I wrote down the experience, and it got published on a blog as part of a blog post by another writer. It was published anonymously, but the writer's name is Jeff Wells, and it was published on the Rigorous Intuition blog in 2005 as part one of his posts. So that was quite nice.
Were any of the triggers that you wrote on the envelopes, were any of them sexual performance triggers?
No.
How did you know? No? Okay.
That would have been embarrassing.
How do you organize your materials before and after use, like the stuff in the bowl and the probably the stuff that you did behind the twos?
I have a large storage area in my studio. You didn't see it in the photos there, but I've got a loft built in there, and it's just packed. I have to go in there and clean it out.
Mm-hmm.
That bowl of letters is, I still haven't put it away. It's still sitting on my desk in my studio.
You do go through a lot of grief and emotions when you are actually doing your paintings and sculptures?
I don't. You know, people ask me that a lot. It's not that immediately, what's a good word for it? It's not that an immediate of a release.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could, if I were directly feeling or blending with the feelings intensely, I don't think I could create the work. But it's definitely a steam valve for it.
Do you, when people see your stuff, do you give them suggestions how to deal with their feelings or cope with it, and, you know, give some give them an idea as to how to help and make a difference? Will you tell them that they're seeing and understanding and believing is helping?
Yes, I always tell them that. And I always thank people for looking at the work, because it's painful. You know, I don't like that aspect of it, that what I'm telling people is painful, but there's no way to get around it. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's really important to acknowledge that they're making a sacrifice. But on the other hand, if you're going to be part of a human community and these crimes are going on, then you kind of have you have an obligation to make that sacrifice too. So, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be acknowledged or that, you know, I shouldn't be.
You live through it. They're just hearing about it. It's different.
Right, right.
Have you had a lot of therapy over the years, and did it help you with breaking the programming?
Yes, I've been in therapy almost constantly my entire adult life, mm-hmm. and I still am. And I have a great therapist who's helped mind control survivors now for over 20 years. He's very, very good.
You're lucky.
So, are there any other questions?
Two things. Do you put little descriptions next to each piece, or would that be too difficult?
I do that occasionally. And mm-hmm. it depends on how much energy I have. Sometimes I'll just put the work out as work, and I'll just put a title. And people have no idea what it's about. And that's when I don't have a lot of energy to explain or to, you know, I almost have to take care of people when I do these shows. And I need people to take care of me sometimes, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Next section coming up, and actually, my trigger warning.
I just want to say that Phoenix asked any advice on how to break programming, and I think that's a whole new webinar.
Yes.
Yeah. Except keep at it. Don't give up.
Don't give up, and make sure you've got a good therapist who knows what they're doing. You know, straight trauma therapy is not going to get you all the way you need to go with this stuff. That's my opinion. It's just my opinion. I can't tell anybody how to heal, but that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. That's what I've learned. You really need someone who understands how it works.
It's easier said than done in most communities to find such a person.
It's a huge problem. There's not enough help out there.
Okay, on to the next stuff.
Okay, and I'll give a trigger warning here. These next four sculptures are really intense. They, some of them are more directly representational than others, but they are all about torture sessions. They're about, the next show is called D.I. Diva and the Mad Machines, and this is a show that I just hung a couple weeks ago. And each of these next four sculptures are about either devices or methods that were co-opted to use for torture in the mind control programs. So that's what the sculpture is. And then next to it, I have a synopsis of how the device or method was used and some copied journal drawings. So it's really triggering. And if you don't want to look, then please don't, because I don't want anyone getting upset. So I'm going to go to the next one, and this one also has underwear in it, so you might giggle at the underwear. So here we go. So this is called Dr. Shermer's Playpen, and that's not me, that's my dad. I usually have a little star next to Dr. Shermer that says not a real doctor, because he was not a real doctor, but my father was, he did tinker around with programming at home and sometimes in the lab. So this is about him and my relationship to him, and which is really awful, just horrible, and informative with me. So he, right from the beginning, he was the main guy. So this is a galvanized steel and fence parts, and this is electrical wire. And these are drawings of hands. And the sculpture is about being in one of the first rooms that I remember when I was a really young kid, like age 4 and 5, 6, where I was conditioned to for sexual service. So that's what this is about. And here's a, I made this up now on Photoshop. It's not, obviously not a real document, but I tried to emulate one of their documents that they used to keep. This is not my real subject number, but it has, the number has meaning to me. But this is, yeah, just a little report on what they were doing. And then here are my journal notes about the room. I have tons more, but I put this one on. But you'll notice also there's a green light here. I have a green light shining on the piece, and then my notes are copied in green. And that's because this happens, I'm sure some of you know, that a lot of programming is associated with colors for various reasons, and that a lot of times, depending on what colored room you were in or what colored light they had in the room, then you associate that color with the conditioning. So this one was a green room conditioning. Now, for me, because it's sexual training, it might have been accidental that the room was green. I don't know, but that's the association for me. So there's that one. So I'll go on to the next one. Oh, I just wanted to say that when I put that at the opening of the show, which was only, it was a week ago Thursday. It was the first Thursday of this month, and it was in the corridor gallery, that gallery that's right outside my studio. And I stood in the middle of that hallway, and hundreds of people came through it, and only one person came up to me. One person. And then my friends came through, and they said, Lynn, where's your work? You only have two pieces. And I said, no, this is all my work. And they were so stunned to see something so different from me. And I guess they didn't know that I did sculpture. So it was a very odd night. And I had to remind myself that I was giving the audience really difficult stuff again, like I had in Franklin. Really hard stuff to deal with. And they were upset. The ones that read the card next to the piece were upset, and then the ones who just looked at the sculpture didn't, there was a lot of disinterest, which I found a little frustrating, but it's upsetting for people. But I'm glad I did, I needed to do this. This is like the next step I needed to go in. So this is called Dr. Wada's Method, and Dr. Wada is a real doctor, Japanese-American, who developed a method for testing for hemispheric dominance in people with epilepsy, and it's a way to inject anesthesia. They do it with some fancy equipment nowadays, where they use the femoral artery, but you get it up into one carotid artery, and it goes up and anesthetizes half of the brain, and then the corresponding opposite side of the body you can't move if only half of your brain is anesthetized. You can't move the opposite side of your body. So the perpetrators used this method with me to train me, to condition me to not have a lot of contact in between the left and the right side of my alter system, to isolate alters to either the left or the right brain. And it's been such infuriating conditioning to overcome. But when I do break through some of it, it's just this amazing, I can actually feel more of my brain working together. It's this amazing feeling inside. But here again, here's a sculpture, and I made it out of plaster. I hand-carved this out of foam, and then I coated it on plaster. And this is a clear tubing. And then here's the description of how Wada's method was used. And here's some of my journal notes. And these journal notes are like, God, these have to be like 7 or 8 years old now. But I have a lot of these drawings. So now the next one's really disturbing too. I'll go to the next one. So this is called Dr. Riker's Box. And hey, if any of you guys remember a Dr. Riker, or even with a T on the end, I'd be intrigued. You don't have to tell me here. And, you know, if you ever want to send me a note, because I remember this guy, and I've tried to do some tracking down, and I've had a little bit of success tracking him down, but not anywhere near like I'd like, but I have so many journal drawings of this box, this little black box with these metal prongs that stuck out in the back, and they put it on my mouth, and it's just this horrible, shocking device. But so in the sculpture, I made a wooden box, and then I covered it with plaster so it looks like plastic. It's got some boo-boos on it. I wasn't too terribly successful with making it look like plastic, because I'm new at using plaster, so I've got a bit of a learning curve to go. But well, here there's a trigger plate.
But I hear a siren in the background, and I just wanted to mention that, because it may be upsetting people, or maybe some people think they aren't not hearing it when they were hearing it.
Oh, but yes, I'm sorry. Now. My building's right next door to the fire department. So I don't notice it anymore.
Okay,
so
I just wanted to say I'm sure it's real. Okay, go on.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Very real. And, there's sirens all the time. So there's a trigger phrase here about memory carved in front, and again my subject number for the show that I'm using for the show. It's not my real one, but these are little drawings of mouths, and this is electrical wire, and then some clear filament coming off. So that's pretty directly representational of what this would be in terms of sculpture.
Can you read the words on the session record?
I'm sorry?
Can you read the words out loud on the session record?
Yes. It says, aversion conditioning and section heads non-access. It says, conduct indexing, semicolon, aversion training via electroshock, semicolon, prevent system section cross-accessing. And then parentheses, CPET cross-referenced with alter coordinates. So that's a really shorthand way of saying what they're doing here. But I'd imagine a lot of you guys understand what that means.
It means keep the alter separate and don't let them communicate.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then this, under equipment, it says in-house device, Dr. Riker. And then what the device does. So it just delivers shocks to the mouth. Yeah. And then here, I'll go to the last one. How about that? So this is another sculpture I did. This is a weird one, even for me. But I got put in isolation tank a number of times. A really old-fashioned one. It was all made out of cast iron. And there was even a little window, or I think there was a little window, but I'm pretty sure there was, but there were these made-up wooden steps and going to this hatch, and there was liquid inside, and I'm sure you guys know what an isolation tank is, but that's why it's called Dr. Lilly's tank, because Dr. Lilly was the one who originally came up with the isolation tank, and this is a red scene. And here, this sculpture that I made, and it's made out of foam again, insulation foam, because I'm used to working with it. And it's covered with black velvet. And then in places, the velvet's cut away. And then in other places, there's like this really shiny material that I, liquid that hardened that I put on the velvet. So it's like all these different experiences of black. And then the wires are supposed to, remind you what it's like to get a tiny stream of light coming through and how bright that is. And then here again, there's like a little kind of window here. So this sculpture is more the experience of being in the tank and what that's like. And then this kind of goes with it. Here's my drawing of feet and wires. But this one's about punishing some alters that were still working on the system's behalf instead of for the perp, so they're punishing them and making them go out of the body and making the experience of being in the body absolutely unbearable. So what they would do is they had me in the tank, and any time I accessed those alters, they would deliver shocks to my leg. So it was so intense, because when you're in a deprived environment, your senses are reaching out for any, you know, stimulation, and then all of a sudden you're overloaded with stimulus. So it's horrible.
How did they know you accessed an altar?
Because they had monitoring on my head. They had monitoring.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the end of that section. I have those four sculptures are on public view as we speak. The gallery's open right now, and people are walking through there. I don't know how many, but a few. So this show is up right now, and it's the most explicit and difficult show I've done, like I said, since Franklin. And there's absolute silence on it. There's no press coverage. There's nothing, and I don't expect it. So there it is. So that's pretty much it. That's it for my presentation. I think I have one more slide. Yes. So here's a backup shot of the little corridor gallery, it's called, but it's got a little reputation. And this is the door to my studio. And here's my contact info. So if any of you guys want to send me an email, or if you have any questions, you know, beyond what we can cover today, feel free to write to me. And also, I have a new website about DID. It's called DIDiva.com. I just loved that name. So I made a website because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to dispel some of the stigma around it, and then I wanted to, so many sites that are just about DID don't talk about why I think most people have it, because of extreme abuse, either ritual abuse and or mind control. So the DID of a site tries to incorporate that into, although it needs some work. So. But it has a comment section on the blog, so feel free to go on there and comment or suggest articles or whatever. Let me know if you think I'm doing an okay job with it. So that's it. Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions? I don't know where to start here. I got a little bit lost. Okay. When did you start remembering, and when did you get out?
I started, it's been such a slow and gradual process, and chunk by chunk by chunk. Like, I think I finally was diagnosed with DDNOS back in the mid-90s, and then it was a couple more years until I got diagnosed with DID, so I dealt with that. But I still had no memories. You know, I knew there was huge trauma, but I really didn't have memories. And then I think pretty much late 90s, things really started hitting me pretty hard. And then I worked really hard with a couple of doctors over into the early 2000s and did a ton of work and got into the mind control stuff. And then I would be a lot further along now, but I have been interfered with since I really started deprogramming, and I mean in earnest. I mean, they don't want me to recover. They call me, they trigger me when they can. So it's been a real battle. It's been a really tough battle, but I'm determined.
Do they access you and abuse you physically?
What?
Do you get kidnapped and abused physically?
Not anymore, no.
Not anymore.
But I do get phone calls, and I get weird contact through the computer occasionally, mm-hmm. when I'm not being careful. I open the wrong email or whatever, so. Or I go to the wrong site a lot of times. That's what it is.
Anybody comes from Seattle and thinks that her perps might have known your perps.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Which sort of leads into my question. Do you know whether your father was part of an organized group and that his, you know, he was working for that group and they were telling him what to do? Or was
Doing
this on his own? Was he like a rogue experimenter?
No, he was working with a group.
Yeah, okay. So he was taking orders.
Yes.
Yeah. And did they really keep lapping out? Because I've always thought that my trainers did, and I wonder what happened to the records. I sort of feel like my whole childhood is in some basement molding away.
I know in my case they absolutely did take notes, And they had to. There's so much detail to keep track of. Mm-hmm. And that's how they, I mean, a couple of times when my guy, I call him my guy, the guy that calls me and triggers me, I can actually hear him reading from a file, you know, because it's not said spontaneously. You can tell he's reading from the notes. So, and I've seen these files. I've seen them. I have alters who have seen these files. So
I'd love to get my hands on them. Do you have any scars on your head from this kind of training sessions and torture?
No. No. All of these tortures that I outlined here, none of them leave marks or scars. No, I only have one scar on my body, and that was an accident. Somebody dropped something, and I was cut.
That's
the only one I have ever had that I know of.
Can you tell us how you break through split brain programming?
Well, I think that, again, that's like a whole other webinar. But
okay.
I use the same general process that I use in rescuing all of my parts out of the past. And I don't know if I have enough time to explain it here. But there's, if you want some general information about it and about the people who use it or developed it, you can go to coreintegrity.org. That's kind of the method that I use.
Would you be willing to do a webinar on dealing with MC programming? Or is that too big a topic?
Sometime in the future, when I could safely be very specific.
Uh-huh.
I need to solidify some stuff myself first. So
when the time comes, give me a buzz.
Oh, I sure will.
Molly Mercurio says, this may be totally unrelated, but she makes a connection to the Dave Reichert of Seattle Police Congress involved in the Green River Killer investigation. Or is this something, it sounds like he was an investigator, not a killer. Or is that
he's
totally
a congressman
something?
Now. He's a former sheriff. But he's too young to be this perp. This
uh-huh.
perp was, he'd be in his 70s or 80s now.
So. Okay.
But no, I'm not a fan of Reichert, the sheriff, or the congressman either. I don't think he's a good guy.
Maybe they're related.
It's quite possible.
What does conduct indexing mean?
An indexing session is when you sit down and you get the subject to pull up each alter according to its trigger phrase or location in the system. It's literally like an indexing session.
And how do they tell which oral, is this PET scan?
They use PET, they use EEG, they use all whatever monitoring systems they had, but mostly it was PET when they absolutely needed a really detailed activity pattern in the brain. PET measures blood flow,
mm-hmm.
so it's a good way to do it.
Okay. And Elizabeth asked, do they put four-figure numbers in?
Four-figure numbers?
Yeah.
yes. A company with letters.
Your session notes on what, I think the last one are the same as for the water method.
Oh, did I copy something wrong? It's quite possible I did.
Oh, okay.
Let me back up here.
Will there be a show there in July?
I'm sorry, what?
Will there be a show there in July? Elizabeth's coming to Seattle in July and she would love to see this.
Oh, how nice. You know, I might have my studio open, but I don't have any art shows planned for July. Actually, I have three art shows up right now. I have this one at Corridor.
Oh my God.
I have a piece down at Ouch My Eye Gallery in a group show, and then I have a group show in New York on Long Island right now. So if anybody's in New York, go see my show. I just got back from New York. It was absolutely amazing experience.
Molly Mercurio says, I'm in the South Puget Sound area now for 30 years, wondering how much longer your current show will be on, wonder if either publicly or privately you would be willing to share some of your therapy journey, how many therapists even, who you have seen or see now. I look forward to meeting you, speaking with you, and seeing your work.
Yeah, you're perfectly welcome to come up. This show is going to be up until the end of this month, the 28th. And then the following month, in April, I'm just going to move it into my studio because I'm curating another group show in the corridor. So I'll just move all these sculptures into my studio and have open studio on April 1st. But the gallery is open from noon to 5 on Fridays and Saturdays. So if you want to come up and see the show, come up on a Friday or Saturday. Send me an email, let me know you're coming, and I'd be happy to meet with you. The therapy, I've been through a slew of therapists. And all of them helped me to one degree or another for where I was at that certain point in time.
Uh-huh.
Except for a couple that kind of freaked out when I got near the really tough stuff.
Yeah.
And that was damaging. But most of them helped me as much as they could.
And then you outgrew them.
Graduating to a higher level of courage, I guess, or knowledge or something, so that they could help me with the tougher stuff. And now I have a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's fabulous.
Is it possible for you to say some of the names of your abusers in case they're familiar to me?
I'm not comfortable doing
that
yet. Mm-hmm. I'm you know, I take these risks with my artwork and online, but I do it in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not like James where I drew the faces of all those people. There are ways that I do protect myself, and I'm not comfortable doing that yet. I named my dad, and that's a big one for me.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, I have perps in common with other people who've come forward, and like Carol Rutz and, you know, some of the German guys. So, yeah, I have that in common with some people, but there are some people that aren't really well known, and besides Dr. Riker, I'm looking for information on him. I'm just not ready to do that yet.
Yep, I think that's fine. There's a problem with the Core Integrity website. Maybe you can find the part that is talking about healing and rescuing altars and send it to me in email, and I can send it on to people. Anything that Lynn references, I'll get the references from her and email it to you when I get the whole stuff together. So you don't have to worry about it now.
Yeah, they don't actually talk about healing programming on Core Integrity, but they describe their general model of healing pretty well. So you can read between the lines and get what they're talking about.
Is this Lowell Rootley, or is that something else?
I'm sorry, what? Yeah, Lowell Rootley.
Lowell Rootley?
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Yeah, and Jim McCarthy.
Okay, because I read his stuff and it just goes right over my head. I just don't understand it, but that's okay.
He talks a lot about how consciousness works, which, you know, if you want to deprogram, you really need to understand how consciousness works, and you need to be able to. I don't know if I want to go into this now. I actually have a. I have an old SMART conference presentation from 2006 where I talk all about this stuff.
Okay.
And so does Lowell Rootley. So I encourage you to read those presentations on the SMART website.
Yeah. I probably have a block. Probably somebody said to me, you will never be able to understand this because we don't want you to. But it's just like, huh? Okay. Molly Mercurio says, I too am now clear that trauma therapy just doesn't cut it or just isn't enough. I long to find a therapist skilled with MCD programming knowledgeable. Have been through therapy hell with this. Yeah, those people are far and few between.
Yeah, that's why I tell people about Core Integrity. You know, it's not a perfect method, and mostly they just educate about how consciousness works and you know, present this possible method, this possible method to use. But what Jim McCarthy does is he travels around the country and he will sit with you and your trauma therapist and educate you on how, you know, on what to do with programming. So that's why I always send people to them.
Okay.
I mean, that's how my doc that's one way that he learned how to work with mind control survivors. He worked with Jim for years, and years ago did it. So
I don't know Jim's work. A lot of people who say that they're deprogrammers and stuff, I do not trust at all. But
I don't call them deprogrammers. They're not deprogrammers.
Okay.
It's just a method of dealing with trauma. It's another method of dealing with trauma, but trauma that has programming overlaying it.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, you know, a lot of trauma therapists will have you go through every action and relive the trauma and go back to the past. And it's the opposite of that. It sort of flips that on its head. They have you, you know, using various methods, bring those alters to the present and into narrative memory first before you deal with the content of the memory so that you're not abreacting.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, a lot of conditioning and programming is sort of like forced abreaction. You know, that's what the alters are going through. They're reliving horrible things.
And if you're doing an abreaction, that alter is going through it again, and it reinforces the programming.
Right, exactly.
But if you get an intellectual framework to put it in, and change it into words instead of body feelings, you've got a different take on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the key is to get that alter to I don't even know how to describe it, but there are ways to do it where you move that alter into the present first before dealing with it, what it went through and its experiences. It's actually sort of a brilliant method. And it didn't come from these guys. These guys didn't make it up. They just, you know, this is the sum of their knowledge of working with survivors of extreme trauma over many, many years. And then studying how the brain works and how consciousness works and what the perpetrators knew and what they were manipulating. So, I mean, to me, they know what they're doing. If they didn't know what they're doing, then I wouldn't have had so much interference in my therapeutic process because it was working. You know, it was working until I started getting slammed so hard. And it still does work, generally.
Do you consider yourself integrated, or do you consider, I mean...
Oh, no, I am not. My system, they did a lot of experimentation on me when I was a kid. I have almost too many programs in my head, and my system is highly complicated and highly structured, and I don't ever plan on being integrated. Hopefully, I'll eventually work like one big orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
I really love that metaphor. One big orchestra with a good, solid director. But not anywhere near it yet.
Did you mean that each program they put in, you'd have a whole different alter set? And that you have like millions and millions of fragments or millions of alters?
I wouldn't say millions, but I'm in the hundreds. I'm definitely in the hundreds of fragments. But they almost pushed me too far. They almost pushed my brain too far with a number of different programs that I have running inside. And a lot of them conflict because I was subject to a little interagency battle in my early teens, my early adolescence, and they nearly... I nearly went over the edge and never came back. So I'm pretty fortunate to be here. I mean, every day I'm pretty fortunate. So I got a ton of work still to do.
I love the fact that you, when you say interagency battles, that you acknowledge that these people, they do the same damn thing that other people do. You know, the bureaucracies are fighting. They're fighting for funds. You know, they're fighting over resources. They're just people like everyone else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Asshole people, but people.
Total asshole people. And a lot of them, you know, they don't get the subtleties of it. One of the weird things I did when I was a subject is sometimes I would raise my hand and go, "You're not doing that right. You got to do it this other way or you're going to fuck me up and it's not going to work."
You were probably brighter than they were.
Oh.
Molly Mercurio says, "You seem so together. Will it be fallout after today's webinar?" And hugs and love to you for all of your courage.
I didn't get that last part.
Hugs and love to you for your coverage.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, there'll be a little fallout, but not too bad. You know, I met with a bunch of activists while I was in New York, and they were absolutely wonderful. So I've been talking about this stuff now for a while, over the last few weeks, and doing these sculptures. So
to survive this as well as the general public.
Yeah.
It's real different.
Oh, it's totally different. Yeah, totally different.
Molly also wants to know whether you've had used medications over the years of your recovery.
No, here's another one of my areas where I'm very, very odd. I refused. I actually got one of my therapists to sign a contract that she would stop offering me antidepressants because
mm-hmm.
I refused to take meds.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time in, I think it was 1996, where I had a really bad, I was hospitalized for 3 days. And it was a great hospital program at the time, too. They knew all about dissociation. They had a really good doctor on staff. And they just basically stabilized me and sent me back out. And they gave me some Buspar, which is anti-anxiety stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it made me so cloudy-headed that, and it made me feel kind of ill. So I took it maybe for a week, and then I stopped. And mm-hmm. that's the only thing I've ever touched as far as psychotropics are
concerned.
There
are a fair number of us who don't use meds. I do, but there are a fair number who don't.
Yeah, it just reminds me too much of, because I so many medications were, you know, I was given LSD when I was 4 years old, so the idea of, it's really bizarre, like I can tolerate programming better than I can something that alters my general way that my brain works. So.
Right. Elizabeth says, you can articulate everything I know, but I don't have words for yet. Did you used to feel like this, that you sort of knew things but had no words to clothe them in?
Yes. I use my right brain to understand a lot of things and to analyze things. And a lot of times when I have to use words then to explain what I've analyzed to someone else, it's like translating into a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
Because when that part of my brain sees and understands something, it's like a snapshot. It's instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And putting it into words is extremely difficult. So I identify, and I might offer, this might be inappropriate, but I'd offer that there might be an alter in your system, if you have alters, that knows how to do that, and that you'll discover
eventually.
To translate
from one side of the brain to the other.
Yeah.
Did you do 12-step programs?
No. Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. People are saying thanks so much about your opinion on meds. No judgment, but, you know, it's just really nice to be validated. So
yeah.
1, 2, 3 people said that. 4. Thank you so much for sharing your art and your experience and findings in your healing journey. You are an inspiration, truly. I admire what you're doing, and one day I hope I can do something public, too.
Oh, thank you very much, Phoenix. It's my pleasure to be able to share this with you because, you know, I'm out there doing this work a lot and I don't get the chance to have direct contact with other people who are going through the same struggle. So
it's
very validating and helpful for me to be able to.
I bet it's lonely.
It gets really lonely, yeah.
Rita wants to ask a question on the telephone. If you do that, could you speak up louder? Because your voice is so soft.
Yeah, that might also be a problem with my actual phone set, but I'll try. So I was wondering specifically about if you notice an effect, well, I imagine you do. I guess I'm wondering what that effect is on your life and especially on your healing from speaking out. Because I do it on a much smaller scale, but I notice that each time I do, even though I'm terrified, it has such a positive effect on my life, and especially on my perception of reality. I find that my reality feels very splintered when everyone out there believes that what happens to us doesn't happen, and that when I speak out about it to people and they respond with, you know, I believe you, obviously, or at least they're relating to me like that's a reality that they can believe in, it feels finally like I'm living in this world as opposed to in a totally different one, which is what it feels like. Sorry, long question, which is why I wanted to ask it out loud.
No, that's that is always been the issue. I mean, the big issue with integrating into society is that society doesn't reflect your reality. And you put that so well. I did meet with a few activists, like I said, this last week in New York, and they get my reality. And I swear it was like, you know, I hate to use this cliche, but it was like hitting an oasis after a year of desert, you know, and just barely, like, scraping every day. And it really affects your sanity on top of everything else. You know, there's this basic, we're social animals. We need to get each, we need to have a shared communal reality that we can agree on to some degree or another. But when there's a rift in that is so huge, it makes you unhealthy. And so when I have those experiences where I'm talking to people and being cared for by people who get my reality, it's amazing. I feel normal. I feel normal. Mm-hmm. And I want to feel normal all the time. And that's one reason why I do these shows. It can't be fast enough for me for people to get it. Not only because I need help, but I mean, come on, I want people to get it. So, but thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Elizabeth would like to speak on the phone too.
Okay.
Elizabeth L. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, Elizabeth?
Hi,
Elizabeth.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you. And,
thank you.
I can't speak much with my left brain. So, I'm not articulated well. It's really helpful.
Lynn, could you understand her between being soft and having an English accent? I had trouble. Could you understand her?
I got a little bit. I got a little bit of it, but not the whole thing. I'm sorry.
I spoke again from here to say about the right brain and how it's difficult to articulate the story because most of it's in the right brain and I don't have the left brain to put it together like you're speaking it.
Yes. But you wanted me to speak more on that?
Yeah.
On how that works, or I'm not really sure myself. Actually, I just know that you know, my right brain has this pretty amazing capacity, and I wish I could access it more. But I do believe, and actually some fMRI studies have shown corpus callosum damage in survivors of trauma. Now, I don't know if they were programmed survivors, but those studies have shown that. So I do think a lot of it is from conditioning, and then some of it is from, well, I was born with my right brain having this marvelous analytical capacity or this sort of visual spatial way of interpreting things. And it just, because of all this interference and all this conditioning, it either wasn't physically allowed, you know, to connect with the verbal in an efficient way, or, you know, it just was interfered with. Either intentionally or not, it was interfered with. So it just doesn't work that well. But it gets better. It does get better as I've been. And there are exercises you can do. I forgot about this. I was hanging out with some people who do yoga and and they don't, you know anything about conditioning or programming, but they showed me these physical exercises that you can do that strengthen the connection between the right brain and the left brain. Now I have no source on those, but I guess if you could Google it, corpus callosum exercises, then you could do some of those. I found them helpful. Does that help? Am I answering your question?
Yes, it's beautiful. Thank you. The most thing that helps is talking and sharing about it over and over again.
Yes, absolutely. It's so important to share the reality of our experience. Absolutely.
Have you ever tried when you're trying to put something into words to do I'm going to pretend that I know or say once upon a time and then just write and see what comes out?
Huh, I know, I don't think so. I don't think I've tried that. That's an interesting idea. Because, you know, if you're conditioned, that certainly is part of it, is your brain does have all this knowledge and it's just the access to it.
Mahoney Mercurio has something interesting too, that she met with David Kaloff in Seattle for a consult, and he had a strong opinion that deprogramming work should come much later in the therapy process. That you
That's what
to
David
do
Kaloff said?
Communication with alters, safety, etc., and be grounded first.
Well, he's not here, so I'm not going to get in an argument with him. I've met him too. I've met Mr. Kaloff as well, and but that was years ago. It was years and years ago now. I don't agree with him.
I think he's a very, very good man. He's a real dear, but I think that all these things happen at the same time. I mean, you can't really like make clear demarcations between the phases.
No, and you can't play some sort of false progression on someone else. It's individualistic, I think, anyway. But I'm not a doctor. So, not a real doctor. I get the little star by my name, too.
I want to do more on MC stuff, because I think it's something that nobody touches. At least we don't touch it much on survivorship. And, you know, I know that you don't feel ready to do it now, except that you've been doing it today. But if you have other people that you think would be in a position to give a webinar on MC programming, I would love to have their names.
I do. I know a few people.
Would you email
me? I work sometimes with Ellen Lacter. I don't know if you know her.
Oh, yeah. No, Ellen won't do things until she's really, really sure she has all her ducks lined up in a row.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I know she does presentations on programming quite a bit, because I've given her material. She's done a few presentations on some of the programs that I've outlined in my recovery.
Yeah, but she's just very scholarly about it and wants to be completely thorough and know everything before she feels that she's ready.
Oh, okay. Well, I can think of some other people, too.
Yeah,
and
think
also
of them. Drop me a line.
Okay. So is there anything else?
We've come to 2 o'clock. I've got a little bit more time if people want to continue.
Jeannie?
Yeah, do people want to keep on going?
Yeah.
Kitty says your purpose statement on slide 2 was wonderful. Verbalize what I've not been able to state clearly. State, is it okay to borrow some of your sentences and phrases?
Oh, sure, please do.
It's
up on my website, too, so.
Just give credit.
Yeah, if you want to.
Yeah. Elizabeth says I just want to talk and talk and talk and talk. Yeah. Why don't...
Oh, aren't there some good organizations in the UK, though? It seems like I met a couple of activists from, it's probably far away from me, but in Ireland.
There are good organizations, but it's still lonely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they do much better in Europe with understanding dissociation. I mean, have much longer history, a less medicalized history over there.
I don't know. I think the grass is always greener. But I thought San Francisco was a wonderful place to heal. And I moved from Boston and found it no better or worse.
Wow.
Since people are paying for phone calls, we could end the phone call and just keep going in the chat. What do people think about that?
I kind of like the idea of talking if people are into that. I mean, like, verbally for a little bit.
Okay.
I guess because I tend to, you know, say several sentences at a time, and typing that into the little box is a little overwhelming for people to read often. But I was actually wondering about, I'm trying to work with fabric art. I was the person who, I'm trying to work with fabric art. And I was the person who asked the question about, art materials, like how you can, you know, get funding for them. And so I'm wondering, especially if people have ideas on how to get free, supply of fabric for fabric art.
I would go on Craigslist into the free area and keep a watch on that.
Oh, thank you.
And then there's, I don't know where you are, but there's...
Canada.
A lot of times there are little... excuse me, my cold is getting to me. There are little networks of artists that you can tap into, and, you know, other artists will trade with you. There might be a craft society in your town, and if you get on their mailing list or you talk to someone connected to the craft organization or craft guild, they can help you with finding fabric and materials. The woman who I took care of, and now I run her estate, she was a fiber artist. And so I know there are a number of professional organizations, national and local, for craftspeople.
Okay.
Because they're more of a... I mean, fiber art can be absolutely fine art. I'm not trying to make any demarcation there, but you might have better luck tapping into one of the guilds in your city.
Yeah, I live in Toronto, so it's kind of big. I'm sure there's something. It'll just be, you know, challenging to weed out, you know, because there's...
Oh, you're getting some good answers on the chat here, too.
I should look at that then. Thanks.
Is there anything else?
I want to thank you. This was so much more than I had hoped for.
Well, good. I'm glad. I hope it was helpful, at least in breaking a little bit of isolation for a while. It certainly helps.
Dynamite, Lynn.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Listen, come to other webinars.
Okay.
With the isolation.
Yes, I think I definitely will now. I will definitely come.
Hi, it's Elizabeth. I just wanted to say thank you. And it helps a lot with the isolation.
Hello?
Pardon? I was just wondering if you were also on the Yahoo group. This is Isabel.
Hi, Isabel.
Hi. I tried the LynnShermer.com and the art at LynnShermer.com, and the email bounced and the page doesn't come up.
I think that if I looked at, if you wrote that in the chat, I think my name is S-C-H-I-R-M-E-R, so try that, and it should work.
It worked for me.
Okay.
I checked it, too.
Isabel, do you want to ask something on the phone, or did you just do that?
Yeah.
You just did it, okay.
Same, because the .net, that's your page, too, right? Your art page?
Yes, I have lynnsart.net, and I didn't put it up today because it is so, I mean, some of the links are dead, and I need to, I'm always too busy with client work to do my own site, so I have to, like, every 3 months I'll pick another one of my sites and I'll do it, and that one desperately needs to be updated.
The email I use to communicate with Lynn is art, A-R-T, at lynnshermer.com.
Yes.
And that always seems to get through.
Yes.
Yeah, I used the other one, but now I saw that I misspelled it. So I used the .net one for an email.
Mm-hmm.
Please save.
Lynn, have you made art since you were a little kid?
Oh, yeah. I was one of the first ones in my kindergarten class to draw almond-shaped eyes and to draw, you know, an oval-shaped head rather than a circle and dots, like most kids do. So I evidenced ability to draw really early. And actually, I started telling very, very young. I started telling about the abuse, and I was severely punished for it. So a lot of times it's not easy for me to go make work. I have to really force myself. I have to have a deadline or a show or a first Thursday coming up that will force me into the studio because, you know, I just have these automatic feelings of dread when I go to the canvas or to the paper, and I've got to work hard to overcome that. So it's not easy.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Because, yeah, that's my problem too, the feelings of dread.
I just, you know, I've gotten used to it to a degree where I know it's a certain group of alters and I know what their concerns are, and I just try to calm myself down and reminding myself that it's conditioning, you know. It's not, it's artificial. It's from bad experiences. So I just try to tell myself that, but it doesn't always work, you know. A lot of times if I don't have a deadline, I don't go down to the studio. I watch TV. Do something silly like that. So, yeah. I don't have the best behavior.
Does it help to have a studio outside of your house?
Yes. I make so much dirt now, you know, with the sculpture. There's no way I could have that in my house, even though I live upstairs in
Long Island.
What?
How about emotionally?
Yeah, that helps too. It helps to have it. So at least the work's in progress, because then the anxiety around them that I can close the door on that too. But if you come in my apartment, I have old paintings of mine up everywhere. So I've got artwork all around me all the time.
Yeah, me too. But I just can't do it in here.
You can't do the actual process.
No, not since I moved, I can't.
Yeah.
You sell it?
Like maybe once in a blue moon.
Did you grow up around Seattle, or did you move there later?
Oh, I moved to Seattle in 1991, so I consider this home now. It's the place that I've lived the longest in my life. And I actually moved here. I was living in Atlanta at the time. Why on God's green earth? I still don't know. Well, I have my suspicions, but it was not it was not a good place for me to be. It wasn't a safe place. Not that this is, but I was living there, and I applied to be a part of Survivor Art Show that was going to be at Seattle's Bumbershoot. It's their yearly arts festival, and it's attended by hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, it's huge, and like they have big box office names that come through, and all these venues. It takes place on Labor Day weekend every fall, and I got invited to be part of this six-person show called Silent No More, and it was about sexual abuse. And it was groundbreaking. And we had 20,000 people come to that show. And we had a video made, and we did a discussion panel. And then we had offers to travel it all over the country and internationally. And so I moved out here to be part of the group that was going to organize traveling that show. And we got into infighting, and we showed it a few more times, and then it fell apart. And then the backlash, the whole false memory thing hit about that time, too. So we probably wouldn't have been able to travel it very much anyway, even if we'd managed to stay together. But that's why I'm in Seattle. And I love this place. It's beautiful.
I grew up there.
I'm sorry, what? Where did I grow up?
No, she grew up there.
Oh, you grew up in Seattle?
Silicon. Near Seattle, Tacoma and Silicon.
Oh, yeah.
H is my younger sister. I was born in 1959, so I thought if you grew up there, maybe I knew you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I see a picture, so.
Oh, great. So you don't live in Seattle anymore?
No.
Yeah.
No, it's too close to home.
Yeah, I get you. I do. That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's no safe town anywhere.
Not really, I guess.
You know, one person's safe place is the other person's not safe place.
Mm-hmm. It's a combination of having the abusers there and having every single block be a place that brings bad memories. It really helps to move someplace that's fresh that you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
well, I'm wondering if you sell a lot of your pieces or if you just hold on to most of them because, you know, I don't know.
No, most of the really tough stuff I don't sell, and that's okay because for me it's like a visual record of my recovery, and it's kind of like evidence, I think, in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I was just in New York. I had an opening and sold big drawings, so really happy to do that. I hadn't sold work in a few years. But my friends around here, I've got some crazy artist friends and musician friends, and they, you know, since they know me, they love my work, and so I've sold a lot of work to my friends. And some of them got into debt, which is really sweet. But they look at me and they're like, come on, Lynn, this is my retirement, so you gotta go get famous. So they tease me. But, you know, that's the thing about art is I've found that once you know the artist, then you, for some odd reason, you're just more attracted to their work, and you're more likely to buy it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I never make work with the idea of selling it in mind. I mean, I've never had a lot of success doing that, because once you get that thought in your head, then you stifle whatever's trying to come out of you. And the kind of work that I do, it's not conceptual, really, it's emotional. And expressionist, I guess. You know, it interferes with that process, so it takes the power out of the work, I think.
Yeah, I've been trying to sell any of my pieces, and I can't imagine it. And so I wondered, you know, what your experience was like, because I sort of feel like, well, maybe there's, you know, maybe it's some uncompleted healing or something that I can't let the stuff go. But it just seems too personal, and like I want it to still be mine.
Oh, that too. You know, I sold a couple of paintings back in 06. I had this little show in some artist loft not far from here, and a collector came through who likes to grab up unknown artists before they get known and the prices go up, and he handed me a wad of cash, handed me a grand, and I was starving at the time. I was broke, and I needed the money, but he picked two of my favorite paintings. And one of them, I still regret letting that go. Because, you know, these creations, they feel like part of you. For me, sometimes they feel like my kids. I mean, they're portraits of my altars. They're really intimate works. So it's hard to let them go with a stranger. And I still regret that one. I wish I still had it.
Maybe you could contact him and buy it back.
I might be able to. Mm-hmm. It's probably just in storage somewhere. I doubt he has it out. That's what's mm-hmm. really awful.
Uh-huh.
So, is there anything else? Mm-hmm. So, Jeannie?
I feel really reluctant to let you go. I think this webinar is over, but I don't want it to be.
It felt like such a shot of fantasy, you know, so much of what you talked about is I just have to experience the stuff that I'm moving towards, and it's just marvelous. And yeah, I still want to hold on to that experience, that energy of the sanity and the connection to creativity and the wonderful melding of it in your life that just sounds so great.
Wow, well that's wonderful to hear that.
I agree. I'm just sitting here sadly staring out the window.
You are so sane. That's what I feel. You're so sane.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, you should see me after midnight.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I think the art is like a story of recovery. So I put pieces of artwork one after the other and all over the place makes the story.
Yes.
Speakable.
Yeah.
It is worth.
Yeah, I think so too. A record of recovery.
It's very profound. It's very
Thank
profound.
You.
Mm-hmm. One thing that makes me very sad was that in the beginning, about 15, 16 years ago, I had this huge burst of creativity. Watercolors and things like that. And it just went away. It's like the part of me that did that is just not around anymore.
I remember that.
And it's so sad.
Hmm. I remember that genius in the black.
Yeah, I kind of hope that's coming back. I mean, that's what it feels like in my life. That I had this giant burst a bunch of years ago at the beginning of my healing process, and now it feels like that there was this, like, whole desert for a bunch of years, and, like, it's slowly trickling back. So I don't know if you were looking for words of hope, but... I think it might come back.
Mm-hmm. That was my thought, too. You know, if it's in there and it's part of you, it's still there.
Yeah, but how to reach it?
Yeah.
Not easy.
It comes back with different focus.
You know what they say to writers, that, you know, if you want to write, you know, like, put yourself in front of a blank page or the screen and write anything? So, you know, sometimes I do that with art, you know, put yourself in front of a blank piece of paper or whatever and see what might happen.
Or buy a new Moleskine journal, or one of my inside kids went in half-price books and bought a Wonder Woman journal once. And all that stuff kind of brings it back. Also, there's a book by Julia Cameron called Artist States, I think. And it has cartoons and places to scribble. And we color the book and we look at the book. She talks about morning pages, which is part of her big recovery thing, and we ignore that. But we have had this book. I'm going to get it out. We've had this book probably 10 years. And you just look at it every day, and it brought things back. I think I'll try it. It's a paperback.
Well, Jeannie?
Yeah?
Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
I think that I'm getting a bit tired and hungry. So.
Okay. Okay, well, we will have to say goodbye to you.
Okay.
Thank you
so much. Hey, thanks. Lovely to have contact with all of you people. And I wish you all well in your recovery.
Yes. Many, many of us are on the message boards at Survivorship.
Oh, really?
Yeah, why don't you come on them? I'm looking to hear. Not everyone uses the same name that they used at the webinar, but a lot of us are there.
Oh, okay. I think I need to get a real Survivorship membership.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I'll do that.
That would be great.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'll get that set up then.
Have a
thank you so much.
Take care of yourself. Get a good night's sleep. And
okay.
Thank you ever, ever, ever so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure, and thank you too, and my best to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank
bye,
you.
Lynn.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.